Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, F up the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, F up the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, F up the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
This evening on The Rock Newman Show, I sit down with Morgan State University professor, activist, and author, Dr. Raymond Winbush. Dr. Winbush discusses how he's blazed an impactful professional trail despite growing up in a family ailed by financial struggles and racial discrimination. He'll also break down how racial, economic, legal, and social divides have shaped the black experience in America. That's coming up right now on The Rock Newman Show. Welcome to The Rock Newman Show from the campus of historic Howard University, located in the nation's capital. I'm Rock Newman, and it is my desire to inspire you with personal stories of extraordinary achievement. Dr. Raymond Winbush is an African-American scholar, educator, activist, and author. His writings have been influential in highlighting social relationships in the black community, along with racial and criminal injustice in America. Dr. Winbush joins me now to discuss how he overcame impoverished conditions to become a professional pioneer. And he'll also break down how systematic racial, social, and legal injustices have impacted black America. Dr. Winbush, welcome to the Rock Newman Show.
Good to see you, Brother Rock.
Thank you so much for being here. Whew. Talking about being able to start in 100 different places.
Yeah.
I want to really go to your beginnings.
Yeah.
Because it's a storied history about an impoverished child sort of making it out of a maze.
Yeah.
Not becoming a statistic. And we want to talk about that journey. But before we go there, you did something recently where you posted a photo on Facebook of Muammar Gaddafi.
Oh, yeah.
And it talked about the various things that as the leader of Libya, he had done for the people. And if one reads that list of accomplishments, one finds that the Libyan people's standard of living,
highest in Africa,
was the highest in Africa, and so dramatically higher than it is today.
Oh yeah.
After American and Western intervention. I would like to have you to talk to us about American imperialism, intervention in Libya, in Kuwait, in
Iraq.
In Iraq. I'd like you to give us some perspective, your perspective on that.
Well, let's start with what former President Obama said. He said the biggest mistake of his presidency in terms of foreign affairs was the invasion of Libya. Libya was very stable. It had an incredibly vibrant economy, an unemployment rate that was less than 1%. Some of the things that I listed, you know, if you were, you got subsidies for your houses, free health care, free higher education, everything. So I asked the question, why would then the people of Libya want to give all of that up? So the answer is the United States of America. There's been a systematic attempt over the past, ever since what we call now the Arab Spring, to destabilize the so-called Middle East in a variety of ways. Libya, if you look at it right before that, Gaddafi had said that he was going to try to get the African economy, when he was president of the AU, he was going to get the African economy off of the dollar so that it would be a common currency, similar to what's happened in Europe with the euro. That's right before he was deposed. I think the entire Arab Spring was a joint effort between the United States CIA, the Israeli Mossad, British MI5, all of those groups to say, let's destabilize this entire area. And part of that, and I say this with a lot of research behind it, part of that was to strengthen Israel in the Middle East. There's a much more tangled history to this than we might imagine. It goes way back. Israel technically is safer today than it was 5 years ago even. So a lot of that is, you know, comes to play with that.
Well, let me tell you, that is, that's a rather explosive.
Yeah, it is.
That's a rather explosive accusation, a charge. For the sake of full disclosure, I happen to have been in Libya when the AU met, when Gaddafi gave a speech about tying the, getting away from the dollar.
That's right.
Tying the currency.
That's right.
Of all of Africa to its mineral resources.
That's right. That's right.
When I had these earphones in my ear and I heard that speech,
my first reaction was, I don't know if you'll be able to survive making this speech. Not so long thereafter was the invasion, and then he was being taken out. Now, it was no genius on my part.
No, but you had it right. You had that exactly right. You kept hearing the United States talk about Gaddafi being a dictator, killing his own people, as if the United States doesn't. And as you said, I would have said the same thing had I been at that same meeting. What you find is that the worst imaginable thing to Europe is a united Africa. Nkrumah said it back in the 50s. It's something that is dreaded because so much is extracted out of Africa, not just minerals and how we get these cell phones working and gold and mahogany, but the idea of saying this is a continent that we can continue to exploit even after the fall of colonialism. And Gaddafi had the vision to say, we can get past this. And he was putting his money where his mouth was by donating, I forget how much money it was, but donating money to start a common currency in Africa that would break some of these. I mean, you go to Ghana, they're using the pound. You go to Cote d'Ivoire, they're using the French state, I forget what the name of it. You know, all of these currencies. If you had a common currency, it would start uniting Africa economically.
So you agree with Obama that one of his worst.
Well, I think it was the worst. And he listened to a sister by the name, not a sister, but Hillary Clinton, because he really was hesitant about doing it.
Yeah.
And we kept hearing the rebels are going. Who are the rebels? What we now call ISIS, because ISIS was born out of that whole conflict.
And so, okay, because you study this and you have such an incredible reputation of being very erudite in terms of being able to identify and explain motives, I want to ask you, you say he listened to Hillary Clinton.
He did.
Why would a Hillary Clinton been so adamant about advising him as Secretary of State to invade Libya?
Well, first of all, you know, look, I mean, and I know this is a touchy subject for a lot of folks, but Hillary is a war hawk. I mean, she has a history of wanting to invade nations. The incursion of the United States through AFRICOM during the Obama presidency just increased geometrically. If my memory serves me correctly, we are now in 24 nations in Africa. It has become a proxy nation for staging a variety of things. Hillary knew that, and she wanted to further destabilize the Libya and Iran and Iraq were the three strongest nations in the so-called Middle East, besides Israel. The strongest. Two of those nations have fallen, Libya and Iraq. Iran, as you know, there's a reversal of policy that's being cooked right now between the Secretary of State, Benjamin Netanyahu, and I don't mean that ill-advised, I'm not being sarcastic, and the Trump administration to destabilize Iran, to roll back all the stuff that was made under the peace accords, under a nuclear peace accord under Obama. I think Hillary was ambitious. She wanted to seem tough. The Israeli lobby had a lot to do with that. And she advised Obama to do that, and he said it was his mistake, biggest mistake.
You just mentioned Libya and Iran and Israel. And I cannot get past this without taking this shot.
Okay.
The gentleman who occupies the White House.
45. Named after the gun.
Currently sat yesterday with Israeli officials. And he explained that his secretary Tillerson was doing well. Sitting in Israel, he told a group of people, we just returned from the Middle East. Did you see that?
I did. And I thought for a moment I was having a senior moment. You know, I said, return from the Middle East. He's in the Middle East.
Did you see the guy from Israel?
Yeah.
He's like, oh no.
It's like the Andrew Jackson statement a couple of weeks ago that, you know, Andrew Jackson.
There would have been no Civil War.
He was dead 16 years prior to that. I mean, you know, I was on a show recently and somebody said, well, you know, Trump is just stupid. And you don't want to say that about the President of the United States, but it's true. I mean, he does not read. And I think not, and I guess as somebody who's been around academics all my life, I think reading is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a guy that's in the moment about everything from foreign policy to whatever, that he's in the moment. And there was a news article in the New York Times, editorial called The World Governed by a Child.
Yeah.
And Trump, as a psychologist myself, Trump acts like a child. Theory of moral development by Kohlberg that talks about the third stage of moral development where you're all about yourself. Children are very egocentric.
Sure, sure.
And so is he.
Okay. So you've become, you know, such a highly respected scholar. You're a professor at Morgan State University. As a child, you would not have been pointed to as one who might climb to those heights. Let's go back, because part of what I attempt to do here, part of what I imagine, is that we have viewers out there that have children that are sitting and watching this show with them.
Yeah.
And part of what I always want to try to do is not just to introduce them to Dr. Ray Winbush, now professor, highly esteemed scholar at Morgan State University, but also to let them know the backstory. So let's go back.
Whoa. Well, look, you know, some people say they were raised in the hood and they really weren't.
Yeah.
I was.
Uh-huh. There was no doubt. You was raised in the no doubt about hood.
No doubt about hood. I was born in Cleveland. I'm in Pittsburgh, rather. But my parents were waiting to have me so that they could move to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why was because my father was white-balled in the steel industry. He was an organizer and was trying to organize late 1940s black steel workers who were getting, you know, inequitable pay from the steel mills. They had the most dangerous jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was white-balled. He couldn't find a job.
Mm-hmm. Why do you use the term white-balled instead of black-balled?
Because that's what it was. I mean, blackball, you know, everything blackmail. We know what Muhammad Ali said about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the term whiteball because I think it, as it relates to black people, because much of this stuff is racial. So,
and in large part, his destiny was held in the hands of white folks.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And so he moved. He went to Cleveland. I was born in March of '48. And 3 months later, we were in Cleveland. They were literally waiting for me to drop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know Pittsburgh a little. I have a bunch of relatives there, go there all the time. When we went to Cleveland, we became the poster child for eviction. I remember, and this is no exaggeration, coming home from school with my brother, who was a year younger than me, coming home from school hoping that when we turned the corner or wherever we were, that our stuff was not out on the street.
Man.
We got evicted three times before I reached the age of eight because my father couldn't pay the rent. There were five of us, three boys and two girls. And we were poor. I mean, we were extremely poor.
Ray, let me ask you, man, because you just make a, you just give me a very vivid picture. You're turning the corner, maybe almost peeping.
That's right. That's a good word.
Hoping. And it's called set out. I mean,
we
know the term set out.
Right.
Hoping that your stuff is not set out because the rent's not paid. Can you identify for us the feeling that went with that?
It was a feeling of despair. It was a feeling at that young age of embarrassment because we knew, I remember once we got evicted on off of the street called Longfellow down on 55th in that area. When I came home, it was raining that day, and all of our furniture was out there. It was raining on it, and my mother had tried to throw some plastic over it to just keep it dry. We were wondering where we were going to go. We stayed in a hotel for like two or three nights. I don't know what happened to the furniture, and we moved again. We were very poor. My father, you know, my mother didn't work. My father had a job, but had to support five children, and back in the 50s, I mean, that was like hard to do on one salary.
Yeah.
And not a good salary.
Yeah.
So he took a second job, place called Ohio Flock Co. Company.
Yeah.
So he was working at E.F. Hauserman, working at nights there. We saw him sometimes on the weekends late at night.
Yeah.
But he was trying to make ends meet as best as he could.
Yeah.
I can remember when we saw the furniture, we would, you know, my brother, he would say things like, man, you know, this happened again.
Yeah.
It happened roughly about once every 12 to 13 months for 3 years in a row. Yeah.
Yeah. And your brother, older, younger?
He's younger, 1 year younger than me, Ron. He's deceased, played basketball for Cleveland State, Calvin Murphy, in fact, and was a social worker, ran the largest drug abuse treatment center in the Midwest, in fact, CAAA in Cleveland. He stayed in Cleveland his whole life, literally.
Yeah.
I moved around,
yeah,
primarily to go to school.
So tell us about the time, I mean, so now this is when you're eight, nine?
Right.
10 years old,
right.
You started to have some movement that took you towards academia.
Well, I know now because I'm a psychologist that I was given the Stanford-Binet intelligence test in the fourth grade. I didn't know what it was then.
Yeah.
It was a little test, and they said, we want to find out. Now, this is a self-serving comment, but, you know, I don't mean it to be, but found out that I had a very high IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents had the choice of either advancing me two grades or sending me to this, I guess now we would call it a magnet school or something like that. They chose to keep me in my same age and send me to the magnet school.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fifth grade, I entered this elementary school called Boulevard. I started taking French, took algebra a couple of weeks later, a couple of years later, went straight through to high school. Then I became a goof off. D's and F's in what we call, what they call now middle school.
Right.
And at high school, I was just nothing but a goof off. F, I barely got out of high school. We had the highest, biggest graduating class in the history of state of Ohio. There were 600 students in the class. I graduated something like 490th. So I was way down. Some of my colleagues now, Sharon Draper, she's a very famous children's book writer right now, and she said, Ray, if somebody told you you would have turned out the way you were right now, I was nothing but a goof off. And I'm not just saying that. Just bad grades, playing hooky. My parents have me say, you need to stay in school. So I squeaked out of high school, and then I went to college.
Well, look, one of the reasons why I fought so hard to get you as a guest, because I'm well aware of your reputation in history for refusing to talk about yourself.
Yeah, I don't like doing that.
Yeah, I know, but we're going to suspend that. We're going to suspend that for this next half hour or so here. So you got into college. At what point did you flip the switch?
You know, I think I flipped the switch. There were two things real quick. My brother, my oldest brother, Harold Jr., you know, went to prison for a manslaughter. He killed a white man who had called him nigger and beat him to death. And he went to prison for 5 years. That shook me up. It shook my brother up as well. Our family, it was a big story in Cleveland. And we were ridiculed. I became more introverted. To myself, because of some of the so-called friends I had said, "Your brother, watch out for Ray. He'll beat you up the way his brother killed him."
Sure.
Oh, you know how kids can be.
Of course.
And so I became more insulated, started studying as a result of that. The other thing that happened was that I became a Seventh-day Adventist, believe it or not, and tried to retreat into that. Oakwood University, where I went to school at, was a Seventh-day Adventist school. And I had no intention whatsoever of going to college, none whatsoever. I had planned on moving to Detroit, get a job in a car factory, which was big money at that time. People forget that Detroit was like Atlanta is now for black folk. And I decided to go to college. I didn't even know the entire process. I applied to Howard, believe it or not. They didn't accept me because my high school grades were too low. And HBCUs, as a gift, admitted me, and specifically Oakwood University.
And this is what year?
This is about 66.
Okay.
66.
Okay. Let me ask you before we go. Any memories of a numbers runner in Cleveland during that time by the name of Donald King?
Oh, come on. Look, Scatter and Donald King. Don King was on 150 Euclid.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I knew him as a kid because he was had a lot of money.
Yeah.
There was also, that was when 150 Euclid was kind of the center
mm-hmm.
of black Cleveland.
Yeah.
In fact, the my father always used to tell us, we passed through 150 Euclid. That was the first traffic light mm-hmm. by Garrett Morgan, who was from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
in the world at that corner. He always told us. And Don King was there. This was before he started promoting fights.
Yes,
way
yes,
before.
Yes,
he was a gangster.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, people were afraid of him.
Yeah.
They were very afraid of him. And as you know, he killed a guy.
Yes.
And
yes.
we knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the guys that ran the neighborhood, particularly the numbers on the east side of Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
where I live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I knew him.
I got snowed in at Don's house in Florida.
Are you kidding?
In Boca Raton in 1996.
Is that right?
He and his wife, and they told stories.
Man, that was
they crazy. They sold stories about their Cleveland days.
Winston, what was his name? Winston Willis. I can't. But 150. It was bought up by Winston. I can't think of his first. But he ran pornography.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Up and Don him and this guy named Scatter.
Mm-hmm.
He ran him and Don. Were kind of competing, but they didn't, you know, it was okay. Scatter wound up getting shotgunned.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. Yeah, but no, everybody knew Don.
So you didn't have any much intention to go to, goofed off in high school, not much intention to go to college, but you ended up at Oakwood.
University.
Very conservative, very little
the
tiny
actuary,
town.
Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah, Huntsville, Alabama, that's correct.
That's right.
And so you go to Huntsville, and you don't necessarily think that someone who becomes a black activist and scholar
would come out of Oakwood.
Would come out of Oakwood.
Well, sometimes I think a lot of things in life are timing rock. You know, I came down there at the height of the civil rights movement in '66.
Mm-hmm.
Birmingham had just gone down.
Mm-hmm.
I think also my parents was dirt poor. I remember my father when I went off to college, he gave me a check for $500. He said, "This is all I got," and I knew that wasn't going to get me through college. So my second and third year of college, sophomore and junior year, I worked from 3 to 11. I went to classes 8, 9, 10, 11, 8 lunch at 12. Laid down for an hour. And then from 3 to 11, I worked at Huntsville Hospital as an orderly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 2 years.
Yeah.
I also felt, I knew my parents couldn't get me through college, so I said, I'm going to start making good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I regained the initiative I had in elementary and part of middle school, and I started making good grades.
Mm-hmm.
So I got scholarships in my sophomore year to Harvard, in my junior year to Yale. And I studied there. And I kind of got all of my direction at Oakwood.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I had finished, I graduated cum laude there. I got a full ride fellowship to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, I guess, partially is history.
So you end up going to, into Boston, Harvard, for example. You said Harvard and Yale.
And Yale.
You studied on both campuses.
Right, right.
But I just want to focus on Boston in 1 second, because this must have been in 67. 869 area.
That's right.
Around the time of the whole busing
issue. Thing, it was bad.
And Boston was Alabama.
The only part of Boston that wasn't Alabama was Cambridge, where MIT and Harvard were. But if you went to Southie, I remember one night a group of us that summer I was up there, summer of 68,
mm-hmm.
just a couple of months after Dr. King was assassinated, Robert F. Kennedy, and it was, you could drive through what we call Southie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was white Irish, and they, you know, in what you doing up in here, you better get out of here and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of stayed around Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Summer 69, when I was at Yale, a group of kids said, look, I was studying. That was the same summer that, you know, man landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going up to New York for a concert. I said, man, I got to study. I said, where's the place at? And they told us that it was what's the big rock festival that was up there?
Oh, Woodstock.
Woodstock.
Uh-huh.
I didn't go.
Uh-huh.
But see, Woodstock, I said, I ain't never heard of the place. So yeah. I skipped Woodstock and studied over night. So that was those two summers. But they turned me around. Uh-huh. They did.
And so then you go to the University of Chicago.
Go to the University of Chicago. I had gone to Chicago during the Democratic Convention in 68 when there was, you know, all of those riots, but left there because we knew it was going to jump off.
Right.
So then I went to University of Chicago and started studying.
Mm-hmm. And so you had a, you had this internal radar. I listen.
Yeah.
And I hear you say you left because you knew something was going, you knew it was going to jump off.
The second day we saw the police, and they were ready to get anybody. That's when Mayor Daley,
yeah.
Richard Daley,
yeah.
When he was mayor of that town, and mm-hmm. he was not playing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this was shortly, about 3 months after Dr. King was assassinated, and the cities in the United States, as you know, you remember that stuff, they were still simmering that whole summer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the convention occurred, Democratic National Convention occurred. It was bad.
Now, were you in the draft?
No. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you what I did. I got a high number in the draft and I in Huntsville,
mm-hmm.
moved to Cleveland, moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I don't want to say dodged the draft,
yeah.
but I tried to get out, and the people that helped me get out of the draft was the Quakers. I was determined I wasn't going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped me get out of the, they asked me if I was allergic to anything. I told them bee stings, which I was.
Yeah.
That's how I got out of the draft.
So,
and I'm not embarrassed about saying that either.
I hear you. Yeah. I hear you. So at that time, a consciousness was developing?
It was. And at that time, Cleveland, where I was raised, and Chicago, where I studied, was kind of the center of the black nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Minister Farrakhan was there. Elijah Muhammad was there,
mm-hmm.
still alive at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hakeem Madhubuti,
mm-hmm.
Earlier named Don King,
mm-hmm.
Don Lee. So all of those people were there, and that's where I got my Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, mm-hmm. whom I'm getting ready to edit a book about. She was there. So that was kind of my political education, which has started during the, you know, this between 66 and on up. And I read a lot, too.
Yeah.
I read Black Boy. Everybody read Autobiography of Malcolm X. And so by the time I got to Chicago, I was politically educated.
Were you in Chicago when they busted in the door and killed the Black Panther?
I came there 6 months later, Mark Clark and mm-hmm. Fred Hampton. That happened in December of 69,
mm-hmm.
and I got there in July of 70. It was still fresh. In fact, you could take a tour at that time because the Panthers let you see where they had killed them.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew early on that had been a political assassination. Edward Hanrahan, who was the state's attorney at that time, had orchestrated that with the FBI and a black informant to have those two killed. Had Fred Hampton lived, he would have united much of what was
this
black
community. I don't want to go past this without maybe even you repeating what you just said as an explanation for our audience here, because I think it's a relevant occurrence in the civil rights movement where the power structure worked overtime to demean, to denigrate, and to destroy the Black Panther movement.
Oh, they did.
A movement which was playing its role in trying to liberate black folks and uplift black folks.
No.
And there's a lot to be talked about, a whole two or three shows to be done on that. But I'd like to zero back in on the United States government's role in that massacre.
Well, it had started before that. That was what we call the COINTELPRO era, as you know, counterintelligence program by the FBI. And as you know, all of the organizations were infiltrated. People forget that when Malcolm was assassinated in 65, that the man who breathed in his mouth to give him artificial respiration while he was on the stage was working as a police undercover to, you know, follow Malcolm. All of the movement was, infiltrated at that time. And in Chicago, there was kind of this unholy alliance between the federal government through the FBI, the local police department, and unfortunately some informants in the Black Panther Party who were working for the government.
Yeah.
And I think that that still exists in a lesser form, but in terms of numbers, but in an accelerated form because of social media, that they being the government, can track the lives of black folk even better, especially outspoken black folk, because I know what has happened to me even more recently.
Well, I was just about to ask you, because you matter-of-factly point the finger.
I do.
And I cannot imagine that achieving the status that you have achieved, and I'm going to say fearlessly pointing the finger as you have done, I can't imagine there hasn't been some blowback.
Well, you know, it's like when I wrote my first book, The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys, you know, we were called an endangered species. And see, a species doesn't just get up one morning and say, I'm endangered. Somebody's endangering them. So I pointed the finger at the system of white supremacy, racism, as the culprit. Well, there's certain places I go right now. For example, I always get stopped in London. I've been asked and pulled out of line as I'm going through customs, do you have any guns on you? I mean, that blatant.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote to get my FBI file after mm-hmm. I wrote Should America Pay, edited Should America Pay, which is a book about reparations. And my FBI file, I thought it was going to be maybe 5 or 6, 7 pages or something like that. It was 77 pages. Took me 6 months to get it, and I only asked for a piece of it. I was giving a book reading, When Should America Pay, came out in Memphis, saw this little white guy in the back. The next night I was in Knoxville, which is the opposite side of the state, and the same white guy was there. When I was signing books, I saw him again, ran to him, and I said, who are you? I saw you in Memphis last night. And he told me he was with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He said, we thought you needed protection. Well, I didn't need protection. And he was following me, and he said, and part of what was in my FBI file actually said, he is able to convince audience about the importance of pushing for reparations. That was in my file. So the government is still here. You know, it's not being paranoid. I mean, like James Baldwin said, by virtue of being black in America, you're going to have paranoia.
1984 still here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In spades.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned James Baldwin's name.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Not Your Negro.
Oh, yeah.
Is out.
Which is not the real what he actually said. We know what he said, though.
But this is the platform where we can talk about what he really said.
He said, I'm not your nigger. I mean, look, Baldwin, if there was a prophet in the black community between like 1950 to the time of his death, it was James Baldwin. Baldwin said what no one, except maybe Malcolm, a couple of the Panthers would say, but not only did he say it, he wrote about it, and he wrote extensively about it.
Mm-hmm.
I tell my students at Morgan State, if you haven't read The Fire Next Time, you really haven't read anything about black America. You can read autobiography. But The Fire Next Time just points, you know, where the problem was. So Baldwin was a prophet, and I'm glad this film is out. I'm glad it's staying out and people mm-hmm. are looking at it
mm-hmm.
as well, because it'll give you a glimpse into a mind that just understood everything about racism, white supremacy.
And before we leave Baldwin, I want to say to my audience out mm-hmm. there that if you got that little young kid there with you, mm-hmm. pull up a video of James Baldwin, the prophet that you're talking about,
yeah.
debating William Buckley.
Oh my God!
At Oxford.
Oh my God! That's probably one of the greatest debates I've ever seen in my life. And Baldwin, the two people I quote most in my social media, probably Baldwin and Toni Morrison,
mm-hmm.
because they just have a laser-like vision of the state of African people all over the world and the state of white people and all over the world. And that debate between Buckley and Baldwin is classic.
Yeah. When you talk about African people all over the world, not very far leap, to think about Pan-Africanism.
That's right.
Think about Pan-Africanism, you don't get very far without thinking about a brother that came through this campus right here.
Kwame Ture.
Named Stokely Carmichael, who became
Kwame Ture.
Yeah. Your reflections on him.
Oh, man. I mean, just, you know, you're naming the greats, you know, and Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture articulated the anger that was in African America, but also articulated towards the latter part of his life the anger and what African people must do. It's like John Henry Clark said, black folk are always talk about where we were dropped off on the slave ship. We were dropped off in Jamaica, South Carolina, South America and Brazil, all through the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, instead of us always talking about our differences about where the ship dropped us off, we ought to talk about where the ship picked us up. And see, I think that's what Kwame Ture did.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about and lived the life. I met him one time in Ghana, sat down with him for about 3 hours, and just, he's one of those brothers you just listen to,
mm-hmm.
and you got so much. And he had a vision of a Pan-African world that we have struggled to get since Sylvester Williams in the 1900s did, Du Bois and others, when I taught at Fisk. I mean, how Du Bois envisioned this, and Kwame Ture was trying to put that in action. And I still think we are still in that process of, you know, establishing a true Pan-Africanism throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. He carried that to his dying
he did.
Breath.
He did. Yeah. And I always tell my students, too, read his last letter to the world, in which, as you know, he died of prostate cancer. And he talks, and even in that last letter, he points to fame. He said the CIA had developed ways of giving black men prostate cancer. And he was always just constantly being a political person. And I admire that in him. He has some flaws, as all of us do, of course, but he stayed true to the game. Stayed true to the game.
I want to talk to you about your book and the structure and the advice for developing strong black men.
Yeah.
Just before that, I just recently read comments from Malcolm where he talked about Malcolm X talked about violence.
Yeah, he did.
And he held a mirror up to white America.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, let me explain to you what violence is. Violence is making having us to look at a tree and hate that tree.
That's right.
So that we don't ever try to find its roots.
That's right.
And that's what you're talking, that's what you did to us as a people.
Exactly.
And as we talk about the whole Pan-African concept, that concept that Stokely had, which I mean, literally I called him in a very faint voice, he would answer the phone, ready for the revolution.
That's right.
He's
that's
still
right.
ready for the revolution.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's talk about your book.
Well, I got to say about Malcolm. I think the term self-defense, and you know, mentioned what Malcolm said, it's funny how the term self-defense was a common strategy to be discussed during the 60s. Deacons of Defense, the Republic of New Africa, Black Panther Party, all of these groups. And somehow we've now taken it off the table. I think it's a great thing that we've seen gun sales since the election of 45 in the black community soar. Now some people say, oh my God, he's advocating violence.
Oh yeah, well, I'm waiting for the FBI to come to this door right now to pick you up.
Well, but see, what it is, we're talking about self-defense. We're not talking about what happened to the young brother at Bowie State a week or so ago or anything else like this.
This past weekend.
We're talking about self-defense and how we defend our communities.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I named my book The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys.
Yeah.
And the reason why I named it, because, again, warriors don't just go out and start shooting and killing people. Mm-hmm. They defend their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the greatest expression of Pan-Africanism for black men and black women is to defend their communities, not only with a gun, but with knowledge, with camaraderie, pulling people together to talk to them, to teach them. I think defense is a broader term than we make it. So what I do in the book is simply tell you how to rear black boys in ways that will help them to be soldiers, to guard, protect, and teach our communities. It's as simple
as that. And you wrote that book when?
Oh my God, 2002. I'm getting ready to do a revision of it now. Mm-hmm.
So 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the proliferation of police killings of young, of black men, period.
Yeah.
Young,
and black women.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
Over the last 3 or 4 years that spawned the Black Lives Matter movement, would you modify anything in your book for these times?
I would probably be, and then the revision I'm going to be doing, I would probably be more structured in terms of talking about the teaching of firearms for young black men. Black men already use firearms, as we can witness in places like Chicago or Southeast D.C. or where I live in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
But the gun should be for protection. And I think that energy that young black males have is being diverted in negative directions.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to train our young people, as does the white community with guns, to train their young boys and young girls to use firearms. So I would change that in the book. In light of the police department, I think the Panthers had a model. They followed police. And I think that we, and it's interesting now that, and see, Rock, I'm going to tell you something. I don't think, and I might be wrong, I think police violence against black folk has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
What has changed is social media.
Cell phone.
Everybody got
a
camera
now.
And they can tape this stuff, the old term tape, record this stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they can play this stuff and post it so that millions of people see it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the police have always been violent towards black folk in this country.
When I asked that question, I was wondering if you might say something, might have gone the route of speaking to how to teach young black boys
mm-hmm.
how to survive in an encounter with the police. Now,
yeah.
Before you respond, that's a, and you as a psychologist know this much better than me, but that is a very, very double-edged sword.
It is.
Where when you are talking to a kid about how to come home, how to live, that's real important. That's real important. Handle this encounter in a way where you're going to allow yourself to come home. But part of what you're doing when you do that is suggesting to him that he subjugate his manhood.
Well, no, look, you are on the same page. I'm going to be honest with you. I get kind of tired when, you know, some people call, Randall Kennedy calls it respectability politics, saying, you've got 10 things to do when you meet the police. That always comes out after one issue. Look, Philando Castile up in Minnesota did everything.
Right.
He complied, if you please.
Right.
The brother in Oklahoma that just, his killer, white woman,
lady.
Killer, and I'm blanking on the brother's name. But he did everything correct. Look, I have been almost killed by the police twice. Once while I was a student at University of Chicago, and I wasn't doing anything. So this idea that if you comply, and I've heard black people, you know, expressing these respectability policies, if they would only obey the police, there's too many instances where black folk have obeyed the police and they still have gotten killed. What I advise is to tell the young man, you need to be aware, part of the warrior method say, you need to be aware at all times how racism, white supremacy can impact you in this situation, at the grocery store, at school. It can happen anytime. When I walk out of Howard University, I don't just say, wow, I'm in a place that I can relax. To a degree, yes, as opposed to, let's say, University of Maryland. But I'm always aware and have my radar up that something could happen if I'm driving home to Baltimore or any place else. So we have to teach our children to be aware of what can happen. But this stuff about if the police pull you over, there was a video a couple weeks ago, these young men, they weren't doing anything. They were 12 years old, and the cop had the gun. They were showing it, how he was pointing the gun, telling them to get on the ground. The kids were crying and everything. Those kids were too young to be doing anything. And they were just, it was just intimidation. And I think we also have to understand how racism impacts the lives of our young people, and boys and girls, and how that stuff is played out in the sick minds of white supremacists as well.
I never get tired of asking my guests who I think have a real perspective and sit in a unique vantage point to speak of Dr. Frances Cress Wilson. You're editing a book
yeah.
about her.
Yeah. Wow. What can I say? Frances is probably one of three people in my life, and one of them, and I'm going to collectively talk about my mom and dad, that literally shifted my worldview very quickly. 1981, I was teaching at Vanderbilt. And prior to that, I was teaching at Alabama A&M, and one of my students gave me this little 5 or 6 page article. It's called The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation. I put it on my desk, didn't read it for a few days. One night I was teaching a class, and about 30 minutes before class, I picked it up and read it. I immediately got on the phone. Remember when we used to dial 411?
Yeah.
I dialed 411, called Washington, D.C., asked for the number of a Dr. Frances Cress Wilson. She picked up the phone, and I told her, Frances, you don't know who I am. My name is Ray Wimbush, but I just read The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation, and it changed my life. Of all the people that I've invited when I taught at Fisk, when I taught at Vanderbilt, at Morgan State, she has been my most invited guest.
You read that book, and you said it changed your life.
It did.
What did it?
Because, as her teacher, Neely Fuller, says, racism is not just what white people or a white person does. Dylan Roof, the guy that killed people, in Charleston, he's a racist.
Mm-hmm.
But the system of racism is what she talked about. And as a psychologist, and she was a psychiatrist, Neely Fuller talks about the what the system is.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Frances does is talk about why do they do it.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that people classified as white don't like people who are darker than them? And she goes through why. The idea that they are a minority but have us calling ourselves minority.
Mm-hmm.
That they are the ones that have more diseases and birth defects when they're born than our children do. So her idea of a system, which is, you know, directly connected to what her teacher, Neely Fuller, said, it intrigued me, and as a psychologist and her being a psychiatrist, it tells me the why. And psychologists, as you know, we're always asking why, and she answers the question.
Let me ask you something, and I want to put a proviso here. I recently got involved in a project called the Power Talk series, something that's been going on for several years now. So, you know, I take no authorship of that whatsoever. I just got involved. Before I got involved, you had agreed to participate in that Black Talk forum.
Right.
What made you agree to that? And what do you hope to accomplish? What do you and others hope to accomplish? It's an event that's going to be here in Washington, D.C., the 23rd, 24th of June.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, you know, again, other than psychology, I read history a lot. during the 19th century and even part of the early late 18th century, black folk had what was then called colored conventions,
mm-hmm.
you know, Negro conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that black folk on a regular basis or a timely basis get together enough and simply talk about what's going on with them.
Yeah.
We do it in the barber shop.
Mm-hmm.
We do it in the beauty shop. We do it on the corner. But our scholars and our activists need to talk to the masses of our people in safe areas where they can share their ideas, feel free to question each other. You know, so when Carl Nelson came up to me and asked me to participate, I said, yeah, because we don't do that enough.
Mm-hmm.
When I taught at FIS, we had the Race Relations Institute, which was founded in the early 1940s, and we brought everybody to the, you know, sons of Marcus Garvey, daughters of Richard Wright, a whole right. lot of people that we brought to talk. Francis Wellesley, James Earl Jones, mm-hmm. Chuck D, Max Roach. We brought everybody together to talk about racism.
Mm-hmm.
As Francis said, and I totally agree with, the most important things for black folk to talk about right now is white supremacy, because that is the problem of the world. And if we don't talk about it, it's going to not spell our doom, but it's going to make us harder to liberate our people.
You mentioned the name that I was going to bring up mm-hmm. come hell or high water before this interview was over. Mm-hmm. And that, and you talk about coming together, black yeah. folks coming together.
Yeah.
We don't do that. And there is a history that tens of thousands of individuals
mm-hmm.
came together
right.
in a time that was pulled, and they were pulled together by this powerful force of nature named Marcus Garvey.
Boy.
We've got 2.5 minutes left.
Man, you know, you mentioned the names that are so important to our history. Who was it? I think it was Nkrumah who said that no other book helped him to understand the black struggle on the global basis than the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, before fax machines, email,
hello,
Twitter, Facebook,
yeah.
and all Instagram, organized 11 million black folk in this country around an idea of Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
I mean, if he could do that in the late teens and early 20s before J. Edgar Hoover and his gang got to him, what should we be doing now?
Yeah.
I say during the 20th century that the greatest organizers, the three great organizers, Elijah Muhammad, Martin Luther King, and Marcus Garvey,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, in that reverse order. So I think that we got, you have to study Garvey to understand the importance of organizing and pulling black folk together for a large vision of Pan-Africanism, which Garvey did, and did it the best.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, Elijah Muhammad borrowed from Garvey.
Sure,
Malcolm's father, as you know, was a Garveyite.
Mm-hmm.
And Garvey,
the minister with the Million Man March.
Garvey.
Yeah.
So Garvey influenced. And see, where's the film about Marcus Garvey?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to have a film to
mm-hmm.
reach the
where's
masses
the,
of people.
One of my disappointments in President Obama is that he didn't grant that pardon.
I know. But see, I'm going to tell you, Rock, I knew he wasn't going to do it. You know, I think it was, what's his name? I can't think of it, but he wrote this article called What Are the Drums Saying? I think when you talk to our people, you either talk to them directly and let white people stand behind you and ignore them, or you talk to white people and you let black folks stand behind you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to say that Barack did, but Barack tried to stand between in mm-hmm. the middle of
he
that.
He tried to be in the gap.
Right. And see, my father used to say, Ray, if you're going to be black all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Real simple
mm-hmm.
from a 12th grade educated man.
Yeah.
But it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
You know, when you want to learn, folks, you invite the professor.
Oh, come on, man.
Brother, thank you so much.
And thank you for asking some great questions.
Blessing us and gracing us
thank
here
you.
Today.
Absolutely.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
All right. Folks, that wraps us for this evening. For more information on this program or any other program produced by WHUT, go to WHUT.org. goodbye and God bless.
This program was produced by WHUT, Howard University Television, and made possible by contributions from viewers like you. Thank you.
All right, what's up, world? Welcome back again to our Mix What I Like Live. I'm Jared Ball, happy to be your host. Please, again, go to our mixwhatilike.org and subscribe there so you don't miss anything that I and my entire collective crew and expanded community do across a variety of media platforms and forms of communication. So, again, our mixwhatilike.org there so you don't miss anything that we do. Please do subscribe here, like, retweet, share, all of that good stuff for this channel. And as this conversation goes, please encourage others to join us. And if you see it after the live, please feel free to be in touch with your thoughts as well. Normally, we would want to take a few minutes to talk about political prisoners and all of that and encourage you to involve yourself with that. I want to do that very quickly here, but we want to be respectful and mindful of the time that we have, just about a little over an hour or so with our next guest, so I want to make sure we privilege all of that, so maybe I'll come back at the end and we'll talk up some of that with you as well. Please do get in the chat with your comments. Those of you here live, thank you for joining us, and please do feel free to raise your comments. We'll get to them throughout and as much as possible. And same thing for those who see this after the fact, we'll try to get to those as well. But joining me for this conversation about reparations is one of the most preeminent thinkers on the subject, of course. He is Professor Ray Winbush, who is a research professor and the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. And as a scholar and activist, he is known for his systems thinking approaches to understanding the impact of racism or white supremacy on the global African community. His writings, consultations, and research have been instrumental in understanding developmental stages in black males, public policy, and its connection to compensatory justice, relationships between black males and females, infusion of African studies into school curricula, and the impact of hip-hop culture on the contemporary African landscape. And I would just want to add one thing, as we said, of one of our previous guests recently, Lynn Washington. I would have to say the same thing for Professor Winbush here, somebody who people would have to understand through working with him off the record and outside of the public eye and often behind the scenes, how supportive he is to a number of faculty on campuses where he works and elsewhere. We always have to big that up because it's not a given that people, particularly at the senior levels that he has reached, will be supportive of junior faculty, and particularly those who take certain positions politically where they work. So I just wanted to take that moment to thank Dr. Winbush for his personal support of me and many others as I've seen over the years working with him at Morgan State University. And without further ado, Dr. Winbush, thank you again for joining us, and good morning to you.
Good to see you, Brother Jared. Good to be here.
So always happy to talk to you. And when I was still doing the Academics in Cars series, we were trying to set that up, and through my own scheduling, we couldn't get that to happen. So, you know, I guess if there is a fortunate to this COVID moment, it's a chance to catch up with people, at least, you know, virtually. So I'm glad to do this with you. And you know, given your, again, expertise, which we will talk about over the course of this next hour on the issue of reparations, I wanted to start with this broad question, again, that accepting they are due, not debating whether or not reparations are due, accepting that they are due, how do you think they should be handled going forward, especially given the moment we're in now?
Well, that's a debate even among reparations activists. There's a lot of schools of thought. Probably the most recent one, which I tend to reject, is that has been brought forth by Sandy Darity in his new book. I know Sandy very well, but it's almost like a money only with him. He brings forth and did a study that said that reparations in terms of being owed is something like $6.25 quadrillion. Now, that's a ridiculous figure as far as I'm concerned, but being on C-SPAN and all these other shows, it kind of trivializes what reparations are all about. I think the money-only approach is something that is really something that is pushed by the right wing to again, trivialize reparations. I think it's like, Jed, the civil rights movement, if you want to make that fairly good comparison, that in 1954, you know, after Brown v. Board, of course, that auspiciously was about school desegregation. But spinoffs of that included, you know, open housing, Voting Rights Act, affirmative action, all of that. I think that reparations can take the form of money payments. I do believe that. I think it can take the form of repatriation. You know, my brothers and sisters in the Caribbean said, look, give me $100,000 and I'm out of here. You know, I'm going back to Africa. It can take the form, and I'm just thinking of some of the debates we've had among ourselves, you know, about a reparations bank that would be run by a committee and so forth, which is more capitalistic. My colleague Charles Barron, an assemblyman up in New York, and, you know, we've done a lot of work there, he said, look, don't give anybody any money because all you're going to do is pour it back into the very system that created the problem in the first place. So there's a lot of thoughts. I think land is another one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of my colleagues have talked about that. So it's the debate is still there, but what we all agree on is that they owe us in some form.
Could you expand on that point you raised a little bit about if I understood you correctly, the conservative nature of a money-only approach? Why would, I mean, because I think a lot of people who would hear that might, at least initially, disagree with your assertion. In other words, when black people turn on the TV and they see Sandy Darity or anyone else saying, you owe us, you know, quadrillion, however, what was it? I forgot the number, $6 quadrillion.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, six, and they get specific, 6.25 quadrillion. I mean, I could imagine a lot of people start, you know, cheering him and thinking this is, you know, go brother, go, like, you know, get us that, you know, get us that check as we, you know, why, I mean, why do you disagree consider that to be a conservative,
Well, another person that espouses the money only is Robert Johnson, the former CEO of BET. He had a very, very simple formula. He says, give every man, woman, and black baby, you know, I mean, literally $350,000 a year cash, tax-free. And that amounts roughly to about $14 trillion, which is in the neighborhood of where most people think it should be.
You mean a one-time payment of $350,000?
Right. So if you have if you, your wife, two children, you would get, what is that, 350 times four. That family would get that, even if that baby is 18 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you then eliminate issues like affirmative action. You eliminate people saying, well, we want set-asides and all of that, as if the money cures everything. And it doesn't. It's like saying, you know, years ago, we were going to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, and then there will be no more discrimination against women. You know, or we got Brown v. Board and there won't be any more racism. So I think that money only approaches, I am not opposed at all to giving money for reparations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can cite some examples that have already been done where money was involved. But if that's all it is, I think it gives a more, it's almost like somehow money is going to cure all of the problems and also release the society, specifically the United States, from any other obligations to African people. And I don't believe that.
Almost kind of like saying, you know, Obama got elected, so your political issues are taken care of now, something like that, you know, yeah.
And which Mitch McConnell essentially said when they were talking about reparations. Well, you got Barack Obama, like, wow, you know, I'm supposed to be satisfied now. So that actually was said by Mitch McConnell.
Well, that's actually, you know, well, it's interesting that I plan to bring this up, but might as well do it here. It's a good segue, you know, because some have argued, similar to that, that, well, why should I don't want to get, you know, I'm accepting that reparations are due, but some have argued that one reason that they're not is because not only have we been given Obama, but historically we've been given voting rights acts and civil rights acts and affirmative action, and we've been made citizens and all of these things that are supposedly have opened the door to opportunity and boundless opportunity. But anyway, which is also I've seen led to the debate is, well, when should we count the total number owed? Should it start from enslavement, or should we even just start from Jim Crow?
I think we should start from 1441. you know, I'm going all the way back to when the first Africans were taken out of the continent and put on Madeira Island by the Portuguese. I would start at 1441, and I would probably end, you know, yesterday. I mean,
what time is it now?
yeah, 11:10 or something, you know. So, I mean, I think that, I think the society somehow feels that, you know, I've heard over and over, white people have said to me in presentations on racism, on reparations, they'll say something like, well, didn't we sacrificed 600,000 men during the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, wow, you know. Now, then I ask them immediately how many black people died in the Civil War, and they don't know. You know, as if the you know, what they did in the Civil War. So it's like, I think white people are always looking for absolutions from the sins of the past. And I think doing that about money only with reparations is another nuanced approach to that. And so and also it says, well, if we do that, isn't that enough? And the answer is no. I mean, it'll be enough, you know, like Derrick Bell, you know, the late Derrick Bell said that racism is always going to be here. And everything that you do to expand it, you know, make it grow and everything is another, you know, point at which you've got to do something about it. Now, until we get rid of racism, you know, and you let me know, I mean, my ridiculous colleague Dinesh D'Souza, who wrote a book a few years ago called The End of Racism, and I bought it because I wanted to know when it ended. Was
right.
It June 8th, I don't know, 1999 or when?
Did he give a definitive stop date for it?
No, he just said it was ended because, you know, I mean, we saw that with Obama's election, you know, we're post-racial. No. I mean, those are some of the myths that I think Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about in his books and his writings about that somehow this country is always wanting to escape its responsibility while telling us, black folk and indigenous people, to be responsible and take responsibility. Well, let them take responsibility on certain things.
But again, that's interesting. You've led me to another point I wanted to raise with you, which is this. So I'm happy. There need not be any order to it. You know, but Ta-Nehisi Coates, in many ways, representing a lot of the popular scholarship on the issue, or conversation at least on the issue, is a proponent of reparations. A very famous defense for the case for reparations. So what impact do you think that people like him or other popular discussants of reparations, even those who say they are proponents of it? So, for instance, in other words, you know, so I just said the other day with Adolph Reed that I disagreed with him, that I don't think Bernie Sanders was necessarily a net positive in the promotion of socialism, even though he, you know, is often claimed to have made it more popular a concept. I don't believe that. Is Coates, you know, does he help your argument and your effort, or the effort of those with whom you work on this issue?
I think everybody helps in a little ways, in little, you know, in small ways about reparations. I mean, Randall Robinson at the turn of the century, you know, wrote a book, The Debt, that I think, in fact, my book about reparations, my first book about reparations, The Debt, was an answer to his question, The Debt, Should America Pay? And I made an argument, you know, within the book, with other authors about the empirical history of reparation. Well, I think that Ta-Nehisi did something that I haven't done in my presentation of reparations. Usually I start with the past, you know, 40 Acres and the Mule, Belinda Royale Sutton, and move forward. What Coates did, to his credit, is start now with the mortgage rip-offs that had been occurring for decades in Chicago, and moved backwards to the Civil War, tracing one family in particular. And by the time you get to reading that article, which I think was the brilliance of it, you say, we got to do something about this. So he started in the present and moved to the past. I usually start in the past and move to the present. And I think that, you know, so I've gotten a lot of calls. Well, you know, from housing, I did something a couple weeks ago with New York Housing Authority, because they were saying, well, we've got all this redlining stuff, that historical, what should we do about it? That's probably thanks to Coates. So I think everybody adds arguments to it. You know, my colleague Wade Nobles out in California, he makes, you know, an argument for the idea of psychological reparations. So people like, you know, Lil Wayne, you know, he just sold the rights to his music for $100 million. But so he doesn't need the money. But I think that maybe, and you know, with all due respect to Lil Wayne, he may need psychological reparations. And Wayne makes a contribution about that. So I think everybody adds a little to the argument, including Coates. It's not perfect, because if you read his article, Coates never at the end of the article says, this is how much it should be. You know, I'm glad Sandy said there should be $6.25 quadrillion. And although that's an absurd figure, it at least shows the magnitude of how much occurred to Africans after they were stolen from the continent.
Yeah, somebody was raising the question here, what happened to the $17 trillion? And I was saying what happened to it is it became $6.25 quadrillion. I don't even know what that number is, or how many zeros that even looks. I don't even know what that looks like in print. But you know, when I hear that argument, and one reason why I think some versions of reparations are more welcomed, and particularly on commercial media spaces like that, is because when people hear that figure, it's understood, particularly in those spaces, that white audiences who hear that are going to think, my God, that is a ridiculous number. We're not paying that. And then it can be easily dismissed. So on the one hand, you get the credit for making it seem like you're on, you know, CNN or whatever, or C-SPAN, making the argument. But the hosts and the directors and the owners of those networks know that it's not going to get anywhere. So that's one part of a reason why I've personally taken to arguing something slightly differently, which admittedly has been accused of, made me be accused in some spaces of not supporting reparations. So I want to hear your thoughts on this in particular.
Sure.
So just tactically speaking, any reparative project, particularly one that would transfer wealth, would require a large segment of white Americans to sign off on that. And I just can't see them doing that. I can't see them saying we're going to transfer wealth just to black people. So I said, well, then why don't we just make the target for redistribution, the at least before COVID, the $20 trillion gross domestic product of the country, and just say in perpetuity, X percent of that GDP is going to get redistributed to everybody so that we have free health care, free housing, free schools, everybody has a job, everybody has job training, everybody has clean water, I mean, everything, like the roads get paid, like so instead of the 1% getting a lion's share of that $20 trillion, all of us get it, and that way we don't have to have the arguments over, you know, I don't want my, you know, white people saying we didn't own anybody, why should we pay, and Asians saying, well, we suffer too, and this group saying we suffer too, and then within the diaspora, I mean, you've already touched on it already. There's an international aspect to reparations to your approach, but others are saying, but, you know, only black people here should get it, and to the exclusion of any, even the solidarity work with any other group. So I'm saying to just tactically get around all of that, redistribute everything, and then once that is done within our own communities, all those other reparative projects can be taken up, spiritual, psychological, et cetera. What do you think of that? What's wrong with my argument?
Well, this I hate to say, well, this is what's wrong with your argument.
No, it's cool. You know,
the reason I actually think that the approach of being more specific to the group where the injury occurred is more conservative than your argument. That I don't conceive this society ever getting to a point that is more socialistic, not a la Bernie Sanders, but just saying, why don't we just redistribute wealth? Why don't we have a system that gets rid of the Jeff Bezos and some of these other fat cats and let everybody have a decent living, a decent education, health care, and so forth? I actually think that black reparations are much easier. And see, the other thing, Jared, is that the other thing is that it's like nobody, that radical president Ronald Reagan, reparations to the Japanese who had been interned during World War II. Native Americans, not all of them, but some of the Lakota, some of the Klamaths of Oregon, they have gotten reparations. And we've seen concomitant raising of health care because of, you know, money. This dude in the White House was complaining that his, you know, some of his gambling casinos collapsed because of, you know, indigenous people who don't have to pay tax on that stuff. I think that there's, again, a lot of ways of doing reparation. One that I should have mentioned, I guess, I mean, there's a school of thought among the reparations activists that said, look, black folks just don't pay taxes for the next 25 years. And when I'm saying no taxes, I'm talking about no income tax, no sales tax, no property tax, no type of tax, no payroll tax. And that's a form of reparations. And I know a lot of people who are very strong on that issue. So I think that my plan or our plan is more feasible than say, let's just redistribute wealth altogether.
Maybe you're right. I was just thinking in terms of the amount of support needed for that to happen. I was thinking if everybody's getting something, then everybody would be more likely to support it. But maybe you're right. I think that's a legit response.
Also, I mean, this is my feeling. You know, when I was looking at the Black Lives Matter demonstration for Breonna and George Floyd last summer, mm-hmm. like, the only time, and correct me if I'm wrong, the only time that white people have ever fought white people on behalf of black people was the American Civil War.
And then 12 years after that, the so-called compromise of 1877, they abandoned us to get Rutherford B. Hayes elected president. I told young people, you know, since last summer, I said, look, don't count on white people to help you with your struggle. I mean, it's like, as I have told, you know, Palestinians, don't count on some kind of alliance with Israel to help you get free. You know, I think that white people are always going to resist anything that they perceive as somehow taking from them. I don't care what it is. I mean, they did it throughout our history. You know, John Hope Franklin was my teacher when I was at Chicago doing my degree, and his dad, Buck Franklin, was the lawyer for those who were, you know, killed in the Tulsa Massacre that will celebrate their 100th anniversary, or not celebrate, or commemorate the 100th anniversary next year. Well, Dr. Franklin used to say, he said, I don't care what it is, whenever black people seemingly are making an advance about anything, you know, white people are going to oppose it. So white opposition to reparations is like, that's part of the struggle. We know that. I'm heartened when I see that double the amount of white people now support reparations as opposed to 10 years ago, and much of that support, in quotation marks, came as a result of the demonstrations last summer. But I just never rely on white people to do anything without kicking and screaming to the table.
Yeah, that's why I keep thinking if the argument is particularly the poorer ones, you will benefit too, and you don't have to think of this as being specific help for black people or repair for black people, that they would be more likely to do it. But it's the logic of white supremacy is illogical, so it's hard
exactly.
to track it. So I don't know, and you may I just have to keep thinking about your point. I don't know, and that's why in general I just, you know, support these efforts. But I do want to come back to that point you raised at least a little bit of the international aspect of this, because if as your approach, and one I would agree with, particularly as a Pan-Africanist, that it go back to 1441 and count everybody, well then, so are you saying that the reparations movement be organized internationally and then collectively collect the debt collectively from the West? Or are you saying that each individual African community collectively working go to their particular colonial administrator, for lack of a better word, for repair?
I think both. I reject the notion that Ados, American Descendants of Slaves, what a terrible name, but I reject their notion that we should just think about us. And I reject the whole idea. First, let me just say this. The reparation struggle has always been international. It has never been just about my thing and forget about everybody else. I think that, like, the CARICOM community, the Caribbean community, is very organized about reparations, but they also help us, and we help them. And we've been cooperative in a lot of different ways. I did a workshop with Hillary Beckles in Scotland and was surprised a few years ago, and was surprised to see several African people in Europe with their own reparation struggle. So we help each other. The idea that Ados, and I don't want to make this about Ados, but the idea that somehow we should only think about ourselves in this landmass and not think about our brothers and sisters, you know, throughout the diaspora, to me is just ridiculous. And other thing, you got to look at where Ados is coming from. I mean, they're funded primarily by, you know, anti-immigration white folks from the far right, you know, many of whom are Trump supporters and others. So I think they've got another motive that they don't like to uncover about or expose to the public. So I think it's international, and I've always viewed it as international. And not only me, but anybody who's a true Pan-Africanist sees it as international.
Yeah, that's why we do. We only drink soda here. Solidarity of Dispersed Africans. Thanks, right. Dr. Ichile. And please go check the talk we just had with her this morning, folks. If you didn't see it, it was great. and Blood Honey, I put it at the bottom. Soda is Solidarity of Dispersed Africans. It's a Dr. Hate special. I can't claim credit for it, but I'm running with it because, you know, it's backwards never. And I don't want to make it about them either, but they are having an impact, and one of their leaders crashed one of my Clubhouse chats the other day, or I shouldn't say crashed, wildly supported and encouraged to be welcomed onto the quote-unquote stage for a talk I was involved in, and misrepresented the whole history. So my only thing about them, which I think is being addressed here, is that what is of evidence to me, without even getting to the background or who actually supports them, which I think you're right in pointing out, is the aggressive attack on the radical traditions that many of us come out of. That when you attack Pan-Africanism and when you attack radical nationalism or all nationalism, when you attack the entire African-centered world, when you attack the entire black socialist Marxist world, I mean, they attack everybody. And you know, I'm saying if you're going to wipe out every radical tradition in the African world that has supported Africans in this country, that makes me suspicious of your motives, rather than working with people that have been doing it for so long and buttressing their efforts, trying to replace or supplant them makes me, you know, is one reason why, you know. So anyway, but this, again, this question of the international approach, similar to again, the argument against that group is that there has been nothing that has benefited, as I'm aware historically, Africans in this country that has not had an international or diaspora support to it.
Exactly.
So even if you're just interested, even if you don't, like I used to joke, I'm not a Pan-Africanist because I'm friends with my Gambian neighbor anymore, and I wouldn't be a Pan-Africanist if we didn't get along. You know, even if I'm just out for my own enlightened self-interest, I would want Pan-African support for my reparations. Could you say another word or two about how that is all working, or how you see that international project working in league with one another to support one another in these claims?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I participate in a broadcast every Sunday of Africans from all over the diaspora. It comes out of England with or UK, I guess. They don't like me to call it England. Glenroy Watson, a labor leader there, is a good friend of mine. And we just talk. We talk for an hour about what's going on all aspects of the continent, the Caribbean, and Europe, Venezuela. The fact we talked last week was about Venezuela and the revolution that is taking place there in one very way. But I learned a lot. I think so you intellectually support your colleagues around the country. You should also, as I told, you know, my students, us and others, I said all of us should have what I call a Pan-African project, that you do something that is international. I do something it's small, but I've been overjoyed about it. I buy malaria nets throughout Africa that I pay a little bit each month for that. And other things as well. I think in terms of the international movement relative to reparations, I think that we should just be joined up. ADOS is really an isolated group here in the United States that is making headway among those who know little or nothing about Pan-Africanism and the history of it. You know, so they may know about, I ain't going to mention the name, but they may know about a certain sister and a certain brother from L.A., but they don't know about who Sylvester Williams is or George Padmore or people like that. And we need to be teaching them those issues as well as their view of, Pan-Africanism. Your friend Yvette Madison and I gave a lecture at Harvard, two, three weeks ago, and we were bombarded afterwards by ADOS. I think some of them were bots and stuff like that, but we were just bombarded in the chat room about this stuff. And I mean, and if you're against everything, I mean, that's a nihilistic approach, you know, to so many things. And to dismiss other Pan-Africanists, which they have done very subtly, like Malcolm X and others who have, you know, or Kwame Ture, all of these people, I mean, it just shows that not only an anti-intellectualism, but as far as I'm concerned as a psychologist, shows a tremendous amount of cultural and self-hate.
Well, again, my thing was and remains that it's not an issue of not being willing to disagree or engage.
Yeah.
It's quite the opposite. In my experience has been similar to what you described there. It's the dogmatic approach that they present is hostile and resistant to engagement or discussion. I mean, that was initially what caused my personal break with the two founders, was that I was asking them if they would just have a discussion about what it is that they think Pan-Africanism means and what version of Pan-Africanism they're critical of. And all I got was hostility and neglect and worse. And you know, but, and some of it's going on in the chat here, and I don't want to engage all of that, and I don't want this to become all about them. In fact, quite the opposite. But there is one specific question to something that I think I raised a critique of it. That I'd be interested in having you or each of us address, because first of all, I think the question somewhat misrepresents my point, but I would be interested that the Cali House movement exclusively focused on relief for the aging freedmen, so that's not true that our but my point would be, my point isn't that a reparative project focused specifically on Africans or black people here makes it non-international. What my point would be is that the Cali House movement overall was supported by an international struggle of African people resisting enslavement. And as I've learned in reading your work and others about the history of Belinda, also advocating specifically for reparations, making cases and reference, making arguments referencing other cases that were happening throughout the diaspora. So it's not to say that a reparative project wouldn't be focused specifically on black people here or Africans in Brazil or Africans in Panama or Africans elsewhere, but it would be to say that each one of those efforts is supported and buttressed and made stronger by support of an international movement. Professor Windbush?
No, I agree with that. I mean, you know, that kind of critique, I mean, you know, that's like a, you know, 1 mile wide and 1 inch deep critique, I call them, you know, because it's like saying that the Montgomery bus boycott wasn't an international Pan-African movement. I mean, but it's in the keeping of struggle that Africans have had throughout the globe. We have struggled in Namibia and South Africa, and I see all of those important for the overall global international struggle of Africans against white oppression. So Hilary Beckel says something that I think is just, I've always quoted in his book, whatever the name of his book is, I forget the name of it.
Yeah, but sure. I thought I had it right.
Black Debt of Britain or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, something like that.
Black Debt. But he says essentially what African people have been doing with Cali House, with Patrice Lumumba, with Mandela and Walter Sisulu in South Africa and Tambo, all over the Caribbean, we've been cleaning up white people's mess for 500 years. I mean, that's basically what we've been doing. We've done it with what Cali House did after the Civil War, or what Eric Williams did down in Trinidad. We've been cleaning up their mess. And all the reparations struggle says is that it is time for you to pay us for leaving the mess and for us just to clean it up, and you expect us to, you know, deal with the stuff that you created. So, I mean, a couple of years ago, one of my colleagues, Glenn Robinson, and I, we were asked by the government of Tanzania to deal with traffic
in Tanzania, where Glenn is a specialist about traffic. I was unaware that the most fatal accidents that occur in the world are all on the African continent. Mm. And so when we went to Tanzania, I never was so, I mean, I've driven in Africa a lot, but it's interesting that after the British left Tanzania, after the French left places like Senegal, they pulled the plug on everything, traffic lights. So the people there just got used to not having traffic lights and just driving and helter-skelter. So we had to talk. I didn't know that. But I think that that's another example of cleaning up white people's mess. And I think that's all reparations is dealing with. The British left illiteracy throughout the Caribbean among us here in this country and among Africans in South America and Bahia and places like that. And we got to do something about it. And they need to help us do that. And they owe us to do that. That's it.
So again, tactically, for me, again, it's the same thing with everything. I'm not asking any of us, again, I happen to be friendly with my Gambian neighbor, but that's not why I'm a Pan-Africanist. If we were not friendly, I would still feel the same way, just tactically. And I'm not even saying that we need to be friendly. The same way I feel about white folks. I'm not saying that all Africans need to be holding hands and singing Kumbaya and acting like we don't have differences or hostilities. I'm simply saying tactically. I'm sure that even South Africans, some of whom I've met that don't have a particular love affair for black Americans, do appreciate black America's support for the anti-apartheid struggle. So the same thing would be said in reverse. I don't need you all to love us, but I would appreciate it if you would put a pressure on your leadership to say, give those black folks over there some reparations, and then maybe we can have some conversations about, you know, repairing some of the colonial issues that we still deal with on the continent, as one example, and vice versa. what about this question? I didn't want to make sure we get to it before we have to leave, but what about this question particularly the money form of reparations is acquiesces to the capitalist and imperial system that generates the wealth in the first place. What do you say about that when you hear that?
You know, Jared, this is, as a scholar, this is something that I've wrestled with for many, many years. You know, within the social science, I'm going to answer this in this way. We have people like Naeem Akbar, Wade Nobles, Linda James Myers, who developed what is now referred to as black psychology. We had Joyce Ladner, the former president of Howard, develop what is called, you know, black sociology. We have a plethora of people who have developed black history. I've been critical. Here's a good internal critique that Africans need to have. We have yet, among black economists, to develop a good black economic theory. The black economists that I know tend to say, well, you're going to be capitalist over here, you're going to be Marxist over there, maybe a socialist over there, but we don't have our own theory. And so I've been doing some study with Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, you know, about 50 years ago, and seeing how that's what he was trying to do. But I've been critical of my black economists, brothers and sisters. I said, where's our theory about what an African-centered economy looks like? Does it have to be capitalist? Does it have to be socialist? I mean, is it a combination of both of those? I don't know how. What should it look like? And I think they've been remiss. So I agree that I think that, and Charles Barron and I talk about this a lot, you know, I agree that there has to be, you'll hear black folks say, well, if you give black folks $350,000 like Robert Johnson said, they're going to make the Cadillac dealer rich the next day. They buy 10 Cadillacs and a house or something like, you know, I think that we tend to believe that the only way reparations can be paid and should be paid is to support a capitalist system. I have one brother say, well, if I would get a franchise, what do you mean? I would buy me 3 or 4 McDonald's franchises. Well, see, that's pouring back into the system. So I want to look at more alternatives to how money, capital, if you want to use that term, and economies in general look like. And I think that's part of the reparations discussion, too.
Yeah, it's interesting, and this is way outside of my lane, but I admit I've been looking a lot over the last year, in particular at modern monetary theory, and trying to answer this my own questions about buying power, et cetera. And the simple point that I'm learning or I'm getting from their approach is more or less something a lot of us have been saying in different ways, if I understand it, and I may not, which is that once Nixon took the country off the gold standard, you're just basically making it up, whether it's printing money or a few keystrokes like they did over the summer with the CARES and the HOPE Act and this last $800 billion for the war machine that they passed while everybody's in the streets starving and in lines for food. In some ways what I'm saying is that the reason I keep wanting to focus on the GDP argument is that part of it is the tactical piece, but part of it is also just to say, like, all of this is some nonsense. Like, we don't have to be fussing with each other over, in other words, it's not that they're taking our taxes and figuring out, like, a budget in a household, how do we spend it on this, or do we pay this bill or that bill? No, you can do everything. So my point would be that on some level, it shouldn't matter if the brother wants to go buy 10 Cadillacs or 3 McDonald's, because, yes, it's supporting this current economy, but on one level, it's what would save this current economy. And then my argument would be, once we got to the psychological safety space of, I don't have to kill myself to pay a bill or to pay off a loan, then we can figure out the next step of, well, what new economy do we develop? What new level of you know? Anyway, so I don't know.
I was on a webinar on Saturday with a young brother, and he said, look, I'm going to tell you what the new economy is going to be, and he's into this, cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
Bitcoins and Ethereum and all of this, he said, that we can control totally. I don't know enough about it, okay? I'm just admitting it. But he says that he said fiat currency is dead, like you said, when Nixon went off the gold standard, it's dead. And he said it's going to keep on dying and we need to get into cryptocurrency. And he swears that's going to be the basis of a new African theory of economics. So
I've heard that too. The only reason I disagree with that is because the piece that everybody, including me, leaves out in all of this is that everything is backed up by military violence. So the idea that you can Bitcoin yourself out of colonialism is, to me, as much mythological as people saying you can buy your way or business your way out of white supremacy.
Right.
So I don't know if I agree with that. Like, we're still going to need political organization and political power. Anyway, let me take a quick look at the chat. Is there anything? One other broad thing, you know, because I know we don't have all day. Is there anything else in terms of how you see popular discussions of reparations conducted that you would like to address, even if in brief, in this conversation? Is there something that we haven't said that you would need us to say or to think about at least going forward?
Well, I think this sounds real simple, but for me it's very important. A lot of people who have opinions about reparations know very little about the history of African oppression, and I'm talking about globally. I'm amazed that I raised, like, incidents. Like, I think we're coming up on the anniversary of We Charge Genocide in a couple of days. And I've said that not just to students who are undergraduates, but I've said it to colleagues from, what is We Charge Genocide? I thought that was just an expression. They haven't read the book. And I think that
if I could wave a magic wand across Africans across the globe, I would say, look, spend the next year reading books about our struggle. And I'm talking about not just now, but I'm talking about for the past 500 years. I'm doing a rereading of Kwame Ture's autobiography, which is massive, you know, Ready for Revolution. I mean, I'm learning, I read it when it came out, but I'm rereading it now, and it's just so many insights that come out in that book. So a lot of us don't even know about our own struggle. And we don't know that Patrice Lumumba is connected to the CIA, that his death. And I think if we read more about our history, you know, that we would have an understanding, a greater understanding of what reparations are all about and why people are pushing so hard for it and have been pushing hard for it even before Belinda did in 1780.
You know, it was fun. I mean, first of all, I can almost reach that Ture autobiography from my seat, which is because I think it's something worthy of referring back to, and it is so thick and filled and rich with so much. Now, and I still struggle to imagine how one credited with founding the field of Black Power Studies could write a biography about the man that doesn't reference his own autobiography. I mean, I don't know how Kelly can do that, but I was looking back at the history of Belinda, trying to just get a little bit prepared for today's conversation, and it is fascinating. I would want you to talk a little bit about her, given the breadth of history, because. So she ends up in the 18th century trying to get reparations for herself.
Mm-hmm.
The first thought I had that I would want to ask you about here is, wouldn't part of the response to using her case and cases like hers to get reparations be, but she herself had been enslaved? Right. Professor Winbush, you, Jared Ball, people in the chat, you haven't actually been enslaved. So why should her case be relevant? But in the process of answering that, which I don't really know needs an answer, I would be more interested in you just reminding us about who she was and what she did.
Well, very quickly, Belinda Royale Sutton was captured about 1715 in Ghana. She talked about the men in her, if you read her petition, she talked about the men who came at night with faces like the moon and stole her, and then took her initially, I always forget the name of this island, it's in the Caribbean, and was purchased by this guy named Isaac Royal, with two L's at the end, who also gave the initial funding for the Harvard Law School. In fact, they had a chair there called the Isaac Royal Chair, you know. So when, at the outbreak of the Civil War, I'm going to make a long story short, at the outbreak of the Civil War, her so-called master fled from Boston to Canada because he was supporting the British, and he got out of the country. And she then sued him for 50 years of unpaid labor in 1781. I say in the book that we don't, you know, she was illiterate. I've actually seen the original petition in Worcester, Massachusetts, that was written by someone that lived about 5 miles from her named Phyllis Wheatley.
Mm-hmm.
Or Primus, what's his name, Primus Hall, the son of, what's his name, the founder of the AME Church.
But Prince Hall.
Prince Hall, yeah. Masons. And it's an amazing story that she had petitioned.
You're a funny scholar to remember Primus and not Prince. That's funny how your memory can work. You'd be so deep in it that you remember the harder one and not the easy.
Yeah, the easy one would have been Prince Hall.
Yeah.
But long story short, she won the first year. They gave her approximately $1,500, which in today's money would have been something, I forget, like $20-something thousand. They defaulted on the rest of the payments,
And I'm in the process now. In fact, I've been running back and forth to Boston trying to locate her grave. I believe it's located far from Phyllis Wheatley, who's buried downtown in the same graveyard that Ben Franklin and Alexander Hamilton are buried in, because she was held in high esteem, believe it or not. So,
and it was Antigua, by the way.
I just thought somebody said it was Antigua. Thank you. Thank you. It was Antigua that she was taken to. So, you know, I think that's over 240-odd years ago. And now we'll find there was a woman even before her, Mum Bett, you know, Elizabeth Mum Bett. And she was W.E.B. Du Bois' step-grandmother. She petitioned a year earlier than Belinda. So I'm doing some revision right now of the book, and I'm going to include her in it, in fact.
Okay. In other words, the history for this is old, and people have been making the argument for a long time, because it is, in some ways, it's not that the people themselves are simple, but it's a simple concept. I've been working for free.
And that's what it is, Jared. I've been working for free. I want to get paid, okay? That's it. And people say, well, she was enslaved. Look, we've got Native American treaty violations dating back 150 years, but we paid reparations now. So it's not, you know, reparations and what enslavement is a crime against humanity. There are no statutes of limitations on crimes against humanity. We have a right to collect.
Which is even why I admit to at some points being compelled by the argument that starts even with something as recent as Jim Crow. I mean, if you just even repair from then, it's a steep bill. I mean, so people could say, well, you weren't enslaved. All right, fine. I love the clock starting 1441, but even if you started at 1981, I mean, it would be tremendous. A debt would be tremendous that would have to be paid.
Exactly.
So we'll just have to say as we wrap up, unfortunately, this conversation, that everything is due and every form is due, and everybody that can be down with the argument should get involved and support it. That was the only thing, real quick, that I would want to say is that when we look at the other cases of reparations being paid, you know, because the Japanese only got like $20,000 checks.
$20,000.
They didn't get a lot. And they lost billions of dollars worth of land just on the West Coast. Indigenous people, I can't imagine whatever they've gotten comes even anywhere close to repairing them, since most of them live on $2 a day. And then even foods, you know, when I went back and was looking at Norman Finkelstein's The Holocaust Industry book, first of all, I would agree, since the comparison to Jews is often made, then the comparison should also be the international one, because it was an international struggle for reparations for Jews. It didn't just go, it wasn't just Israel.
Exactly.
The whole diaspora got involved. But more to my concern is that Finkelstein points out that the money got ripped off, long story short. Even the money that got paid was ripped off by elite Jews who ripped off the movement. So as we even look to compare or make comparisons, we should be cautious to not mimic everything that these other groups were doing.
Absolutely.
But Dr. Wimbush, look, I appreciate you coming on with us, and I know you got something else to get to, and having this conversation. I again want to thank you again publicly for your personal support of me over these last couple of years, and many others that I see you doing from the IUR at Morgan State, and for your longtime work on this and many other issues related to African people. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jared, and keep doing what you're doing too, brother. It's very important, very important.
We'll keep on swinging, as they say. But thank you very much, and peace to you, Dr. Wimbush. We'll catch up with you as soon as we can. And I want to thank everybody else for joining me again, and for those who joined us earlier, stuck with us all day. I appreciate it. It's been a long, fun morning of talking to the African world about African problems and African solutions. Please check back with us at imixwhatilike.org and subscribe there. Please, at imixwhatilike for all your relevant social media, like, subscribe, all of that. Keep the conversation going. And yeah, no, I appreciate that. Shout out, you know, and again, that's Dr. Burroughs' concept, and I would love to try to make it as real as possible. And as long as I can sit here and do that, that'd be great. And when we get more involved, we'll do that as well. But anyway, like Fred Hampton used to say to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody. We'll catch you next time right here at I Mix What I Like.
I mix what I like.